Do you want to go to heaven? Why? The Bible talks about heaven, no doubt, in Colossians chapter 1. Paul from prison wrote to the Colossian Christians, he said something about the hope laid up for you in heaven, which you have previously heard in the word of truth, the gospel. So beyond question, the gospel holds out to man the hope of heaven. Look at Hebrews chapter 11. Now that passage talks about heaven, this one we just read, but it doesn't tell you what's there. Why do I hope to go there? In Hebrews chapter 11, look down in verse 10, we see that Abraham was looking for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. When you choose to move somewhere, you want to move to a particular location, you know, maybe some reasons. Maybe it's a job, maybe it's the fact that it's beautiful, maybe there are other reasons. Abraham was looking for a city. One of the things mentioned in the text is that it was a city that has foundations. Down in verse 13, including not only Abraham but other Old Testament men of faith, he said, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. Verse 16 says they desire a better country. So they lived on earth. Abraham was a wealthy man, but there was something better. What was better about this other place that they were looking for? They knew that the end that they were seeking was not here on this earth. We find in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3, in accord with this passage we just read in Hebrews, that there's an inheritance waiting the Christians. It's called an inheritance. Undefiled. Does not fade away. What are we going to inherit? Sometimes people, when they think about heaven, they think about a golden street, pearly gates. Is that what you're looking forward to? If that's what heaven is, I'm not sure that's a big appeal to me. What about you? I think I'd rather have hill country and maybe some trees and streams. People talk about going to heaven having wings like angels. I'm not particularly interested in wings either. What is there about heaven that makes us want to go there? We're going to look at some of the things that the Bible tells us tonight in our study that at least it seems to me are reasons, valid, rational reasons to go to want to go to heaven. I want to begin in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. When we prayed with Mark tonight, he talked about people suffering, people having various problems. We oftentimes in our prayer mention that. We know that people are carrying burdens, either themselves having health issues, their friends having health issues, but sometimes it's not those kind of things. It's the difficulties of living in a sinful world and all the conflicts that that brings about. When you read the first and second letter that Peter wrote, he definitely was talking to Christians in view of that. You read the first five chapters and you'll see that they were living in a world with all kind of conflict. In the first chapter, second chapter, about verse 11 following, he starts talking about people living in a world where there's a government that may not always be what it ought to be and how you react to that. And then difficult situations, servants living with masters who are cruel and oppressive. And then in chapter 3, he talked about women who might be married to men who are not Christians and the difficulty of that. Over in chapter 4, he talked about the problems that arise because they had abandoned their old way of life and they were maligned and people made fun of them and it was difficult. They were suffering. In 2 Peter, you have a similar type picture when he talks about in chapter 2 the world of the ungodly and how not only do they live ungodly, they try to seduce Christians to live ungodly, make it very difficult on Christians. And in chapter 3, in the early part of the chapter, he said they mock your faith in a coming Christ. And so, wonderful place to live, isn't it? Well, in 2 Peter chapter 3, in verse 13, he said, according to his promise, we're looking for a new heavens and a new earth. You mean some better trees and some better hills and some better streams? Is that it? This term, new heavens and new earth, was a Hebrew idiom. It was used in different contexts to talk about different things. In the Old Testament, for example, in Isaiah, that phrase was used to talk about something different from the old Jerusalem and the situation that Israel had with God under that system. There was a lot of corruption and ungodliness. And he talked about a new heavens and a new earth, talking about the Messianic age. But here, these people are already in the Messianic age, enjoying the blessings of being Christians. But wouldn't it be wonderful if they had a place where instead of Satan dwelling, you remember Revelation 2, where he talked about you live where Satan dwells, Antipas had been killed? Wouldn't it be great to live in a place where righteousness dwells? Look at the verse. We're looking for a new heavens and a new earth wherein righteousness dwells. That's heaven. I want to go to a place where there's not going to be any sin. How did sin come into this world in the first place? You know the answer. You go back to Genesis chapter 3, everything was lovely until Satan entered the picture. Satan is the one that tempted Eve. Satan is the one that caused them to violate the will of God, brought suffering and death into the world and all of the other consequences of sin. In Matthew chapter 25, in a few moments, we're going to sing the song that Javier has announced, there's a great day coming. This verse talks about that day. And in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 41, to those on his left, the king will say, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. The author of sin will be destroyed. His power will be taken away. Would you like to live in a place where Satan has no more power to tempt, to seduce, to make sin look lovely, to persecute the righteous? That's heaven. It's not like this earth. This is a new heavens and a new earth wherein righteousness dwells. Look at Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. I used to work in the secular world like you do. I went to the refinery. I would hear the dirty language. I would see the dirty pictures they posted on the walls. You would hear about men cheating on their wives. All the filthiness and ungodliness in the world. I went to high school, a big high school. Ungodliness was rampant among the boys that were there. And, you know, it gets weary to live among that day in and out. People you work with, maybe your own family. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 3. The writer said, immorality or any impurity or greed must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness or silly talk or coarse jesting which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Not one immoral, ungodly, filthy-minded, filthy-mouthed person will be in heaven. That sounds like a pretty good place. It's certainly different from this heavens and earth. It's a new heavens and a new earth where righteousness rules and reigns. It dwells there. Revelation 21 is often used of heaven. Maybe it has an ultimate fulfillment in heaven, but it's a picture of the new Jerusalem compared to the first Jerusalem. It's a picture of God and His fellowship with His people. In Revelation chapter 21, beginning in verse 5, He said, "He who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I'm making all things new.'" And He said, "Write, for these words are faithful and true." Then He said to me, "It is done. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." By the way, that's the assurance that all of this is a reality. He said, "I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I'll be his God, and he'll be my son." That's talking about a close fellowship, a blessing. "But for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." The 27th verse of that chapter 21, 27, "Nothing unclean, no one who practices abomination or lying shall ever come into it." This new Jerusalem does not allow those kind of people in it. And it's the new Jerusalem and the citizens of it that will enjoy heaven. I'd like to spend the rest of, well, there is no time, eternity, the rest of eternity in a place where there are people whose every word, every thought, every deed is pure and holy, godly, deeds of love and kindness. That sounds like a pretty good place to live. And that's why I want to go to heaven. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Here's another reason I want to go to heaven. You know, if I could find a place like that, a place where righteousness dwells, I would never want to have to leave it. I would hope that my rent would never end, as it were, that I would be permanent and enjoy that forevermore. In 2 Corinthians, Paul is explaining about his ministry and the difficulties that he's been going through. He talks about that, in fact, the first seven chapters, but in chapter 4 he talks about being perplexed and stricken down and all of the difficulties that he had been facing. And why would Paul do that? Why would he endure through all of that? He said, verse 16, "We do not lose heart." That is, we do not get discouraged. In our Saturday night study last night, Jeff talked about this very thing. We get discouraged. But one of the reasons we shouldn't get discouraged, Jeff made mention of this, is because of that reward. We reap eternal life. Well, here Paul's talking about that very thing. We do not lose heart. He said, "For though our outer man is decaying," that's this body, it gets old. It's the tent we're living in. It's decaying. He said, "Our inner man is being renewed day by day for momentary light affliction." I guess everything's relative, isn't it? You may get a cold or sinus infection, and boy, this is terrible. Maybe you even get sick and have fever. This man had been in prison more than once when he didn't deserve it. He had been beaten. He had been maligned. He had been shipwrecked. He had to flee for his life. And on we could go. And yet he says, momentary light affliction? How in the world can that be momentary light affliction? By way of comparison, it's relative. Look, he said it's producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. So he is talking about comparing, isn't he? Far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen. And when Paul looked in the mirror, if he had one, he could see the stripes in his body. But he said, we don't dwell on that. We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are constrained by time, temporal. They don't last. But the things which are not seen are eternal. They have no time constraints. For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. And he goes on to talk about this dwelling that we will enjoy. I would like to live in heaven because there are no time constraints. There's not an end to it. To live in a place where righteousness dwells and it will dwell there, I don't know if tomorrow is the right word, but forever. And you don't ever have to worry about something's going to upset it. And you'll have a body, I don't know what it'll look like, but it'll never get sick. It'll never die, never hurt. I'd like to live in a place like that, that's eternal. That's heaven. That's one reason I want to go there. Look at Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4. Look in verse 8. If Joshua had given them rest. You know the story of Joshua. You know that those people had wandered in the wilderness for the past 40 years. I don't know what it'd be like to live 40 years in a wilderness. Every time you move, you have to pick up your tent and all your belongings and travel to the next place and set up your tent. That's how you live. Oh, by the way, ladies, you wear the same clothes. Now, that would really be tough on women, wouldn't it? Wear the same clothes, the same shoes for 40 years. Shoes didn't wear out. Clothes didn't wear out. Boy, it'd be great someday if they could just settle down, have houses, and have gardens, and have peace. That's what Joshua was leading them into the promised land. He said, boy, that's rest from all their labor. But he said, if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. That was just really a type of the final rest that God has for his people. He said, so there remains a Sabbath rest. Don't think of Sabbath, Saturday. Cessation of labor, that kind of rest. Your labors are done. A Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Very applicable to the readers of this letter because as you read the letter, you see they were going through periods of discouragement. He's trying to encourage them. They were suffering from their old friends. They were being tempted, trying to tell them that they had made a mistake in becoming Christians. Don't you get tired of fighting those battles? And not only that, they actually had people evidently going into their homes, ransacking their homes, taking their goods, having them thrown into jail. When's it going to be over? There's going to be a rest. And it'll be over. It'll be done. All of those things that bring us so much heartache and pain will be behind us. In Revelation chapter 14, you're familiar with the first three chapters of Revelation, particularly chapter 2 and 3. Where he talks about all the things those early churches were going through. There were the battles, doctrinal battles. You know, the church at Ephesus had tried those that called themselves apostles and were not and found them to be false. There were the battles with immorality. There were people that were immoral among them, trying to seduce Christians, and some were succumbing. There was the battle of actually being killed for your faith, going into prison and then being killed for your faith. All kind of struggles. And you read those letters to those seven churches. In Revelation chapter 14 and verse 13, look at the hope that's laid out for them. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. You know the Ephesian letter in chapter 6. Paints the picture of a Christian engaged in a life and death warfare, battle, struggle. He said in verse 11, put on the full armor of God. Why do you wear armor? To protect yourself in battle, to prepare yourself for battle. Some of this armor is aggressive as well as defensive. And he said, so that you be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And it's a warfare where you're involved with forces so much greater than you are. Our struggle, he said, is not against flesh and blood. It was against flesh and blood. Yes, they fought against false teachers and error, but there's greater forces involved. He said, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you be able to resist to the evil day. And having done everything, to stand firm. Stand firm, therefore. Get tired of fighting? Well, I wish the war was over. I don't know what it was like back in the 1940s. I was just a little baby. But what it must have been to read the news or hear on the radio, the war is over. My dad had three boys that went to war. What must it have been to hear the war is over? I want to go to heaven because you're going to rest. You lay down your armor. You won't have to fight anymore. That's why I want to go to heaven. It's a place that God promises for His people that is a place of rest. Look at 1 Thessalonians in chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians in chapter 4. Verse 13, I do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you'll not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with Him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. The Lord Himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. There are many indications in the New Testament that we'll be able to recognize people. I don't know how to reconcile that with the fact we'll realize there are some absences. I don't know if God will so inform us about the justice of judgment or if He'll do something to our thinking that will cause us to be able to deal with it. I don't know about that. But I do know it is a great hope to be able to look forward to the day to be with all the righteous of all the ages, including loved ones who've died in Christ and gone on before. Is this a legitimate reason to want to go to heaven? Read the last verse. Comfort one another with these words. God hadn't promised you're not going to die, that your family's not going to die, that your friends aren't going to die. But my, if we can convert them, if we can teach them the gospel, if we can help them be faithful to the end, when they die, it's just a temporary time until we're reunited. I want to go to heaven and be with people who died in faith, clean from their sins by the blood of Christ, looking forward to singing with the angels around the throne of God. I want to be in that company of people. In Philippians chapter 1, you're reading from a man who's writing a letter in prison. You know that. Sometime early in his life, probably in his early 30s, his life took a 180-degree turn. He was out trying to find people, Jews, who confessed the name of Jesus and persecute them. Something happened on a trip that he was taking. His life totally turned the other direction. He began to give his total devotion to this person called Jesus Christ. He said he saw him in a vision. Never saw him on the earth. Saw him in a vision, heard his voice. I don't know if he ever saw him again. He was taken up to third heaven one time. Maybe then, I don't know. But here he is in prison, somewhere between 61 to 63 A.D., depending on when he obeyed the gospel, maybe 25 years after that. He said, I'm ready to die. I'm okay with that. Why? Here in Philippians chapter 1, verse 23, he said, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Now we talk about being with the righteous of the ages that have passed. But what would it be like to look Jesus Christ in the eye? To touch him. I don't know what the new bodies will be like. But I believe when we die, we have the hope in heaven of being with Christ. Is there anybody, if you could meet one person, would he not be the one person you would want to meet? That's heaven. I would like to meet him. And that's why I want to go to heaven. Turn back to Matthew 25, where we began our study tonight. I hope that in these passages from real people with real hope, real problems, and you see what they were looking forward to, we can see something better about wanting to go to heaven than golden streets and pearly gates and angel wings. But there's another reason. We started out reading from Matthew 25, verse 34, how he was inviting people to inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And then we began to explore what it meant to inherit the kingdom, the blessings of the rule of Christ. That's those specific things that we've been looking at in those passages. But that's not all that's going to happen on the great day that's coming that we're getting ready to sing about in just a few minutes. You'll note back up in verse 32, he says he's going to separate this multitude of people. One from another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. To those people on the left, here's what he said, verse 41. Depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. There have been many who have written that hell can't be real because there's not going to be any real fire and real words. And I wouldn't even argue that point. But I know this, that's the imagery that you use to picture hell. The most painful, disgusting, distasteful imagery is used to picture hell. It's a place really for the devil and his angels. I hardly think it's just extermination. That would be bad, but I think it's much worse than that. To the eternal, he says, the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Down in verse 46, he calls it eternal punishment. Oh, all those people we said that weren't going to be in heaven, You know, he said, I don't like to be around hypocrites. Well, get ready to spend eternity with them if you go to hell. I don't like murderers and rapists and all of that. Get ready to be with them eternally if you go to hell. One reason I want to go to heaven is because of the alternative. I don't like the alternative. Jesus warned about this over and over again. He spoke more about hell than he did about heaven. In fact, on one occasion he said, it's better to have your eye plucked out and your hand chopped off than to go to hell. That's how bad it is. And Jesus knows about eternity. He is eternal. So I want to go to heaven because I don't want to go to hell. We can make that decision as to where we want to go right now. Once we die, it's too late. We can make the choices, the priorities, the sacrifices that will prepare us for heaven now. 1 second, I guess, after we die, we'd have wished we'd have made them if we hadn't, but it'll be too late. And so God, in His great love, holds out heaven for us. In the face of difficulties and disappointments and trials, the face of suffering and pain, as an encouragement, because He wants us to go to heaven. It's for us. In Hebrews chapter 6, in verse 17, how strongly does God want you and me to believe that Christ died for me and for you to take away our sin so we can come before the righteous God without fear and have that hope that He secured for us. Verse 17, in the same way, God desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of His purpose, interposed with an oath. Does God have to take an oath? Why, no, He doesn't have to take an oath. And somebody that's not truthful, taking an oath is not going to make a whole lot of difference anyway. God didn't have to take an oath so He'd tell the truth. God took an oath for you and for me. He wants us to be absolutely confident of the promise of the inheritance made possible through Jesus. And He said, He interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things. One is, He said, it's impossible for God to lie. But then there's the oath. Two, He said, unchangeable things. We who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul. When you face the storms of life, and the winds are blowing and the waves are raging, things seem so difficult. Can I keep on going? There's an anchor. Look, there's faith, hope, and love. The Bible talks about them over and over again. Faith is absolutely essential to our redemption. Faith is essential to our hope. Love is essential to serving God and treating our fellow man correctly. But we're not going to make it without hope. You won't make it without the other two either. But hope is an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and one which enters into the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. We talk about hope as an anchor. We talk about the imagery of a storm. I would hate to be on a ship of that period, first century, in the middle of a storm. We're not talking about a ship with giant motors. They didn't have any. Propellers, internet, satellite. You're out there on this boat with sails. And up comes the storm. The winds are blowing. The waves are raging. This chapter, chapter 27 of the book of Acts, they're in the middle of that kind of storm. Even the seasoned sailors are worried they're not going to make it. They're scared to death. On the boat is a man who's not a sailor. Don't know if he'd know how to hoist a sail. But he's confident they're going to make it through the storm. Why? Here's the answer, Acts 27, 25. He said, verse 22, he said, I urge you to keep up your courage. What's the opposite of that? Discouragement. He said, keep up your courage, for there'll be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For this night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood before me, saying, do not be afraid, Paul, for you must stand before Caesar. Behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. How is God going to do that in the midst of this ocean? I don't know that Paul had any idea. But here's the answer in verse 25. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. We've been reading what we've been told by God through His prophets. And if we believe, it'll be exactly as we've been told. There's no storm so great, but what we can be confident. God has a plan for us to stand, not before Caesar, but before Christ, and hear that blessed invitation, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joys of your Lord. Are we ready for that decision to be made? If death should strike us this night, are we ready to go to heaven? You think about that as we sing this song, there's a great day coming. It's a sad day for some, a great day for others. We'll all be part of it. We can help you getting ready for it, then won't you let us know as together we stand and as we sing.